This is April 22nd, 2012, and this will be the second of two Teishos on tribalism, this phenomenon of grouping together with others. Last week, in part one of this two-part Teisho, I focused on race and divisions of race and how difficult it is for us to not have racial bias, at least unconsciously. And there are tests and research that shows that we're really up against a wiring problem with racism, where it happens so fast that we may not even be aware of it. And so what I was mostly trying to get across last week was the importance of awareness. No surprise, this is a meditation practice, that the key to not letting our racial, even unconscious racial bias get the better of us, is to maintain constant vigilance and watch for it, and even assume that it's there in some degree. And then when we operate from that assumption that it's there somehow, then we won't be completely deceived by it. There were some points that, as usual, after Teisho, I thought of that I wanted to make. Maybe the most important is how mistaken it is to think in terms of being a racist or not being a racist. And from a Buddhist perspective, what's wrong with this is it substantiates what is insubstantial. That is, one of the fundamental realizations in Zen and in Buddhism is the illusory nature of self, that there is no fixed permanent self. So to call someone else a racist, or even oneself, it may be, in a relative sense, it may be true, but puts the emphasis on what is not really fixed. That even though I think any time we use nouns like this, it can be misleading, because yes, we may have racial bias, every single one of us, at least unconsciously. But to say that makes us all racists is misleading, because there is no ist, there is no self that we're stuck with, that we can work with this, we can work with our racial bias. And I think it's just a problematic word, racist, even though in a relative sense, yes, we know there are what we can call racists, but there is always the element of freedom to change and work with these biases that presumably we all have. It may be that last week's Teisho on racial bias was prompted by this very spectacular case of the killing of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. We're going to see all kinds of things played out there in the coming weeks or months. I would submit that none of us knows exactly what happened, other than the fact that George Zimmerman, by his own admission, killed Trayvon Martin. But it's an intriguing case, because it's really easy in a case like that, where none of us was there, none of us saw exactly what happened. It's an intriguing case in how we may project onto the thing our own biases, our racial bias in one direction or another. A very, very tragic, terrible situation. The thing that happened. And our tendency as human beings, when we don't know, is it's very hard to abide in not knowing, and our knee-jerk reaction is to impose on a state of not knowing some presumption of knowing what happened. I think a better thing to focus on is this sick law of stand your ground, and how that contributes to a situation like that, and how terrible the consequences can be of such a law. After Taisho, there were a couple people who offered their thoughts about what I'd said in Taisho, and one of the interesting ones was someone brought out the kind of totem pole dynamic of how human beings seem to need to have others to look down on. If it's not someone of a different race, then it's someone of one's own race that had one has to find something inferior about. And the social or environmental aspect of racism, that we, as one of these people said, it's in the air we breathe. We live in a society that has big, deep problems with racial bias, and it's certainly part of it. That is our history of slavery and the 200 years since then, that makes it so difficult for any of us to be free of racial bias. I think of this famous saying by the great enlightened layman from India, Vimalakirti, in whose name there is a sutra, actually, the Vimalakirti Sutra, where he said, "I'm sick because the whole world is sick." And if we imagine that we have no, not even unconscious racial bias, even in the faintest degree, then we might consider the famous dialogue where the great Chan master Zhao Zhou or Joshu was approached by a monk who said, "What if I have no thought in my mind?" And Joshu said, "Throw it out." And the monk said, "Why? How can I throw it out if it's not there in the first place?" And Joshu says, "Well then, carry it out." There was an article in a recent Newsweek magazine about tribalism, an article by an E.O. Wilson. I didn't even know he was still alive. He must be quite old. In which he makes the case that our need to divide the world into us and them goes beyond conditioning, beyond learning, but is genetically determined. Not all social psychologists and other, I mean, social scientists agree with him. But it seems pretty reasonable to me when you consider the anthropological evidence, the seemingly beginningless chronicle of war and other forms of tribalism. He says in his article, by the way, just about a little bit about Edward O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, naturalist, and synthesizer of fields, has been challenging scientific orthodoxy for decades. He's won more than 100 awards, including 2 Pulitzers, and he's still making people mad. This time, he's contesting the most central premise of today's evolutionary theory, that we are willing to sacrifice ourselves for our families. In fact, he argues, like some ants or termites, humans have evolved to defend other groups, whether a country, a football team, or a faith. It is this social nature that has made us the world's dominant species. And then he says here in this article, research has shown that tribal aggressiveness goes well back beyond Neolithic times. And there's a good chance that it could be a much older heritage, dating beyond the split 6 million years ago between the lines leading to modern chimpanzees and to humans, respectively. Our bloody nature can now be argued in the context of modern biology is ingrained because group versus group was a principal driving force that made us what we are. In prehistory, group selection lifted the hominids to heights of solidarity, to genius, to enterprise, and to fear. And then in the article, and this is from earlier this month, April 9th, Newsweek, he introduces this concept of eusociality. That's EU, sociality, eusociality. The drive to join is deeply ingrained, a result of a complicated evolution that has led our species to a condition that biologists call eusociality. Eu, the prefix EU, of course, it means pleasant or good. The eusocial group contains multiple generations whose members perform altruistic acts, sometimes against their own personal interests, to benefit their group. Eusociality is an outgrowth of a new way of understanding evolution, which blends traditionally popular individual selection with group selection. So, individual selection based on individuals competing against each other, and then group selection and competition among groups. Individual selection tends to favor selfish behavior. Group selection favors altruistic behavior and is responsible for the origin of the most advanced level of social behavior, that attained by ants, bees, termites, and humans. He says among insects, eusocial insects, the impulse to support the group at the expense of the individual is largely instinctual. But to play the game the human way required a complicated mix of closely calibrated altruism, cooperation, competition, domination, reciprocity, defection, and deceit. Humans had to feel empathy for others, to measure the emotions of friend and enemy alike, to judge the intentions of all of them, and to plan a strategy for personal social interactions. Elsewhere, I've read the quite reasonable hypothesis that we had to band together in prehistoric times in order to defend ourselves against these much larger mammals, ferocious creatures that wanted to eat us. As a result, the human brain became simultaneously highly intelligent and intensely social. It had to build mental scenarios of personal relationships rapidly, both short-term and long-term. Its memories had to travel far into the past to summon old scenarios, and far into the future to imagine the consequences of every relationship. Ruling on the alternative plans of action were the amygdala and other emotion-controlling centers of the brain and autonomic nervous system. Thus was born the human condition, selfish at one time, selfless at another, and the two impulses often conflicted. Well, as we go on, I'm going to make the point that just because you're ready to sacrifice an individual for your own group doesn't make you selfless. He goes on later, we're skipping through much of this, the tendency to form groups and then to favor in-group members has the earmarks of instinct. That may not be intuitive. Some could argue that in-group bias is conditioned, not instinctual, that we affiliate with family members and play with neighboring children because we're taught to. But the ease with which we fall into those affiliations points to the likelihood that we are already inclined that way, what psychologists call prepared learning, the inborn propensity to learn something swiftly and decisively. And indeed, cognitive psychologists have found that newborn infants are most sensitive to the first sounds they hear, to their mother's face, and to the sounds of their native language. Later, they look preferentially at persons who previously spoke their native language within their hearing. Similarly, preschool children tend to select native language speakers as friends. The elementary drive to form and take deep pleasure from in-group membership easily translates at a higher level into tribalism. People are prone to ethnocentrism. It is an uncomfortable fact that even when given a guilt-free choice, individuals prefer the company of others of the same race, nation, clan, and religion. They trust them more, relax with them better in business and social events, and prefer them more often than not as marriage partners. They are quicker to anger at evidence that an outgroup is behaving unfairly or receiving undeserved rewards, and they grow hostile to any outgroup encroaching upon the territory or resources of their in-group. And then just a little review of the research I mentioned last week. When in experiments, black and white Americans were flashed pictures of the other race, their amygdalas, the brain's center of fear and anger, were activated so quickly and subtly that the centers of the brain were unaware of the response. The subject, in effect, could not help himself. When, on the other hand, appropriate contexts were added, say the approaching African-American was a doctor and the white was his patient, two other sites of the brain integrated with the higher learning centers, the cingulate cortex and the dorsolateral preferential cortex, lit up, silencing input through the amygdala. Thus, different parts of the brain have evolved by group selection to create groupishness as well as to mediate this hardwired propensity. So this is the tension that we face as human beings, is our hardwiring and our ability to mediate that. When the amygdala rules the action, however, there is little or no guilt in the pleasure experienced from watching violent sporting events and war films in which the story unwinds to a satisfying destruction of the enemy. So here too, as with racial bias, we need to just accept that we are inclined, as an instinct, to associate and trust those who we perceive as belonging to our group, and there are many ways that can play out, more than others who we see as not being part of our group. And again, this can be overridden, as in the ways he says. But there's so many different overlapping forms of group identity. Of course, some of the most obvious are our country, nationalism, our national identity. But then that can get broken down into smaller forms of identifying with our state, New York State, or our region, Western New York, our city, Rochester, or our neighborhood. I think that one of the signs of growing comfort with what could be broadly described as tribalism is the proliferation of these banners you see on street lamps and showing the neighborhood, whether it's East Avenue or Park Avenue or South Wedge or these others that have their own color and distinctive design, identifying it as a particular neighborhood. And even within a neighborhood, there can be other divisions of one's own street, identifying, okay, I live on such and such a street. I live on a street called San Gabriel, and it's only two long blocks. That's the whole length of it, two long blocks. And the other half of the street, those people like to call it Upper San Gabriel. which they would probably justify because it's right up against Cobb's Hill, so it's maybe a foot higher in elevation. Race, we mentioned as a form of tribalism. Sex, the sex we identify with, and that can be male, female, or gay or bisexual or transgender and so forth. Our generation, the boomers, the Gen X, Gen Y, and so forth. Our social class, our college, our high school, and within that, our class of 1966, class of 1986, our vocation. And within our vocation, different fields, like in psychology, say those that are the Jungians and the Freudians and the cognitive psychologists and so forth, behavioral psychologists, and of course sports. There is so much primitive outbursts around sports affiliations and joy and despair. And look, we see the riots that occur after not losing the national championship but winning the national championship. And then Wilson mentions this here somewhere. Talks about when the Celtics defeated the Los Angeles Lakers from the NBA championship in 1984. The mantra was "Celts supreme." And then a social psychiatrist who saw the aftermath said, The fans burst out of the garden and nearby bars, practically breakdancing in the air, stogies lit, arms uplifted, voices screaming. The hood of a car was flattened, about 30 people jubilantly piled aboard, and the driver, a fan, smiled happily. It did not seem to me that those fans were just sympathizing or empathizing with their team. They personally were flying high. On that night, each fan's self-esteem felt supreme. A social identity did a lot for many personal identities. And then, politics. Partisan politics, identifying as a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. Independents, I think, may sometimes pride themselves on not thinking independently. They're not either, they may think that they have no identity, but there could be identity of being an independent and an attachment. Interest groups. There's been this massive proliferation of interest groups and the power of interest groups in this country, from trade unions to every kind of interest group we know, and the lobbying that goes on their behalf. Within colleges, there are sororities and fraternities, and those who pride themselves on being neither. When I was in college for the first couple of years, I was in a fraternity, and if you want any kind of modern version of tribalism, there it is. This is various fraternities and sororities, and then there were those who weren't part of it, which we called, in our fraternity, we called them GDIs, goddamn independents. And then the biggest of all, religion. Identifying with one's religion, and within one's religion, one's particular school or sect. Think Shiites versus Sunnis. And the denomination within the sect of our religion. And then we have all these ways of displaying our group identity with t-shirts and bumper stickers. And I've also noticed a proliferation of these little ovals on the back, oval decals on the back of cars that identify you as having some affiliation with the Adirondacks or with this or that region of the country. We do seem to need to identify with a group or multiple groups. And it would be a mistake for us to reject that tendency. We don't need to reject it. We just need to not be attached to it, to the groups we identify with. There is a particularly ticklish area of group identification. In particular, what I'm thinking of is identifying and taking pride in one's minority group, such as the phenomenon used to be called Black Power, where identifying with pride of one's race or one's sex, feminism. I think this here, we can acknowledge that especially for minorities, if you're in a position as a minority where you lack the power of other races or sexes, then it's natural that as a movement toward equality, that there would be a feeling of pride and wanting to assert oneself as a way to redress the imbalance of power, this position of subordination. Is the thing Roshi Kapila used to talk about, decent pride, taking a decent pride in one's group, whatever it is, one's. And I think this is a valid, especially as a minority. And let's face it, in Zen we are a minority. In those pie charts you see every once in a while of religious affiliation in the United States, we're part of other. This little sliver you can hardly see on the pie. They don't mention Buddhism, much less Zen, but just other. Nationalism so easily curdles into jingoism and through patriotism on the way there. And then this notion of loyalty. Loyalty is another thing, like taking like pride in one's minority group. Loyalty is something that is admirable, and yet can turn into something that fosters suffering when it's pitted against others. There's this old idea. I don't know who said this, but someone said, my country, right or wrong. So it doesn't matter what my country does. By God, if it's my country, then it has to be right. This, I think most of us would see as kind of crazy. And this gets us into, I think, a valid distinction between Republicans and liberals, and Democrats, or conservatives and liberals. Another article that that caught my eye recently is a review of a book in the New York Times of a book called The title is The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, by a Jonathan Haidt, not that Haidt, but H-A-I-D-T. And just to read a couple little things from this, it's a fascinating article, and I think a quite a balanced article. If I can risk trying to summarize it, he talks about how Republicans tend to be more in touch with our human instincts, and Democrats more with rationality, reason. That's oversimplifying it, but just to get broad strokes, he talks about Haidt, the author, has read ethnographies, traveled the world and surveyed tens of thousands of people. He and his colleagues have compiled a catalog of six fundamental ideas that commonly undergird moral systems. And these are the ones: care, fairness, liberty, loyalty, authority, and sanctity. And he talks about, discusses how liberals and conservatives, or Democrats and Republicans, place different weight in these things. Loyalty and authority and sanctity being more strongly valued by Republicans, and fairness and care more emphasized by Democrats. And this is what gets us into our topic of group identity. The world views hate discusses may differ from yours. They don't start with the individual. They start with the group or the cosmic order. They exalt families, armies, and communities. They assume that people should be treated differently according to social role or status. Elders should be honored. Subordinates should be protected. They suppress forms of self-expression that might weaken the social fabric. They assume interdependence, not autonomy. They prize order, not equality. These moral systems aren't ignorant or backward. Haidt argues that they're common in history and across the globe because they fit human nature. He compares them to cuisines. We acquire morality the same way we acquire food preferences. We start with what we're given. If it tastes good, we stick with it. If it doesn't, we reject it. And then skipping here, he says you don't have to go abroad to see these ideas. You can find them in the Republican Party. Social conservatives see welfare and feminism as threats to responsibility and family stability. The Tea Party hates redistribution because it interferes with letting people reap what they earn. He says that the Republican themes are faith, patriotism, valor, chastity, law and order. Whereas Democrats, he says, focused almost entirely on care and fighting oppression. And then he introduces the phrase parochial altruism, the inclination to care more about members of your group. And he says that conservatives understand this better than liberals. Saving Darfur, submitting to the United Nations, and paying taxes to educate children in another state may be noble, but they aren't natural. What's natural is giving to your church, remember that, giving to your church, helping your PTA, and rallying together as Americans against a foreign threat. Liberals, he says, don't understand conservative values, and they can't recognize this failing because they're so convinced of their rationality, open-mindedness, and enlightenment. And then he says, our task is to organize society so that reason and intuition interact in healthy ways. Well, that's all the time I have to read on that article. So, if this, let's say this is true, that this is human nature to emphasize faith, to value faith and patriotism and valor and chastity and law and order. These what are, he says, our traditional Republican values. Okay, let's say it is our human nature, our instinct to go with these things. Here's where we can consider whether there is something we can find beyond our instincts, beyond our human nature. And I think a lot of this comes down to human nature as compared to our true nature. Now, I have to be careful here because human nature is not outside our true nature. Nothing is outside our true nature. Human nature is an expression of our true nature. But it also has limitations in it that you don't find in our true nature. So let's say that patriotism, jingoism even, blind loyalty, parochial altruism, to use his word, are instinctual in us. Does it mean we can't go beyond that? We can't broaden our circles of identification? Okay, same thing. Tribalism, group identity. Can we not work toward, even as we recognize how much we are determined by our need to identify with groups, the way we need to divide the world into us and them, can we not so completely buy into it that we can't have a broader, a more inclusive way of understanding the world? And that's what Zen practice and Buddhism offer, is getting beyond our parochial, more narrow instincts. And this goes way back to the words of the Buddha himself. I'm going to read here from the Lankavatara Sutra. And then Mahamati, it's one of the great enlightened disciples of the Buddha. He said to the Buddha, "Why is it that the ignorant are given up to discrimination and the wise are not?" Here, in terms of this topic, we can say discrimination means discriminating against us and them, the in-group and the out-group. The Buddha replied, "It is because the ignorant cling to names, signs, and ideas. As their minds move along these channels, they feed on multiplicities of objects and fall into the notion of an ego and what belongs to it." What belongs to it. That's the group thing there. If we talk about the I, the me, and the my, what we're talking about today is the my. My group, my religion, my politics, my party, my neighborhood, my sports team, and so forth. They make discriminations of good and bad among appearances, think of uniforms and other things, and cling to the agreeable. As they thus cling, there is a reversion to ignorance, and karma born of greed, anger, and delusion is accumulated. As the accumulation of karma goes on, they become imprisoned in a cocoon of discrimination, love that phrase, a cocoon of discrimination, and are thenceforth unable to free themselves from the round of birth and death. So there's a lot at stake here in terms of not getting attached to our group identities. Have your group identities. We can all appreciate ways in which we can bond with others. And I'm not only talking about the Sangha, but all these other ways. Ways that we can, yes, feel pride in being Americans. I've often been critical of our country in my talks, but there are also many things we can be grateful for. And if you don't think so, spend more time outside of the United States and you may get a better understanding of it. Yes, we can identify with our group, and so but this is the razor's edge that we talk about in Zen. But not getting attached, not doing it at the expense of others. That's where we create karma. That's where we create suffering. Here elsewhere in the Lankavatara Sutra, so long as people do not understand the true nature of the objective world, they fall into the dualistic view of things. Us again, us and them. They imagine the multiplicity of external objects to be real and become attached to them and are nourished by their habit energy. Because of this, a system of mentation, mind and what belongs to it, is discriminated and is thought of as real. This leads to the assertion of an ego and its belongings, and thus the mind system goes on functioning. Mm-hmm. So we can see this tension, this contradiction between the value of identifying with one's groups and the danger of it, as placing us in a kind of dilemma, a kind of koan. And this is one of the values in Zen, one of the reasons that koans can be so valuable, is that by working on the koan, we learn to understand the wholeness of it. Every koan has a contradiction in it, and it's tempting us to go one way or the other. And as long as we do that, as long as we think the dog has Buddha nature or the dog doesn't have Buddha nature, then we miss the whole. And we can see this instinct of tribalism the same way. Can we accept it, that we are wired that way, and there is some deep need to divide into tribes? Can we do that without completely buying into this notion of division? It's half of the story. It's just one aspect of reality. The other aspect is the undifferentiated, that which goes beyond divisions. Or as Chuang Tzu said, behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. That's what Zen develops in us, Zen practice develops in us, is this other. Everybody knows about the divisions. Everyone pretty much lives out of divisions, us and them and self and other. And what Zen practice develops is this experiential understanding of the other side of things, the undifferentiated. Just a passage here from a Chinese Zen master, Yuan Wu, who was accredited as the author of the Blue Cliff Record. And he's referring to this undifferentiated by one of the names that it's been assigned over the years, over the centuries, is the Tao, the way. He says, "This Tao is deep and remote, beyond the time before heaven and earth had taken shape, and sentient beings and Buddhas were separated. It was profoundly clear, solid, and still, as the root of the myriad transformations. This Tao shines and glitters, and none can fathom its limits. It is absolutely transcendent and lies beyond the scope of concepts and images, or divisions, we could say. There is nothing that can be used to compare it with." Once we have seen into this realm of the undifferentiated, what is beyond tribes and self and other, then we can accept our ways of identifying with groups and tribes. We can delight in them, and we can delight in other people's identifying with these groups and tribes, because we know that underneath all these divisions with their names and so forth is this one mind. So we know how to neither deny our human nature, our human tendency to toward tribalism. We don't want to deny it, nor be bound by it. Okay, or as Roshi Kaplan once said, when there was a lot of agitation, and this was during the women's lib period of the late 60s, and he posed the question, what were you? Ask yourself, what were you before you were a woman? What were you before you were black or white? What were you before you were a Zen Buddhist? Or a Hispanic, or a German, or American? We'll stop now and recite the four vows.